Hello and welcome to the Nourish, Balance, Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly and today I'm joined by the strength and conditioning coach, James Wilson. Hi, James.
How's it going, Chris?
Good, thank you. I wanted to get James on. In fact, I've wanted to get James on for the longest time. I've had fantastic results following his blog and podcast as well, actually, which I will link to in the show notes for this episode. And following James's training programs for strength training, gotten really good results. And I think I first tried to get you onto the podcast about a year ago and didn't have much luck. So I'm kind of excited to have you on now.
Awesome. Yeah. It's probably about a year ago, as some people know now, I was starting to develop my new pedal. So I had some things going on behind the scenes and was pretty busy and couldn't really tell a whole lot of people about what was going on. So yeah, I apologize about not being more available, but no, I usually love to take any opportunity I can to come on and talk with people that have had, you know, luck with my, or I shouldn't say luck really, because it's not luck, but had good results with my programs. And yeah, I just love to spread the word and talk biking and training and just, yeah, all sorts of fun stuff. So thanks for keeping on me and getting me on. Appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah. And, you know, we're used to talking about things which are quite controversial on this podcast, things like gluten sensitivity and blood sugar and diabetes and stuff like that. But I think anybody who's easily offended by the idea of using flat pedals on a mountain bike might want to find another podcast to listen to, because I know they're out there. I already posted one article on my website, and it was just this overwhelming, it was like by far the most engaging article I've ever written. And it's partly because there was a mistake in it. But yeah, people really get riled about this stuff, you know, like whether or not they should be using clipless pedals or not, but we'll get into that later.
Yeah. No, it all kind of, definitely, ties into my overall training philosophy. I think when people understand kind of how I view things, and it's not an either or sort of thing, it makes more sense. But, you know, like you said, there's a lot of knee jerk reaction to stuff. I mean, really a lot of things, like you said, like you mentioned, like gluten sensitivity, or, you know, it doesn't really matter. Flat pedals are what does it in our circle. But man, every circle has that one subject that's just a little less contentious than religion in the Middle East peace process kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, for us, it just happens to be pedals.
Yeah.
And, but yeah, like you said, man, you start to, mention anything about using flat pedals, or they may not be worse, as bad as people make them out to be. And yeah, you start to find out real quickly, you know, what people's real thoughts are on it. But, anyways, yeah. So, but I'm sure we'll get into that.
Yeah. So let me tell you a bit about my background with your training program. So, you know, I've like ridden mountain bikes since I was a kid, actually. And then kind of fell out of it, you know, when I learned how to smoke and ride a motorbike and all that kind of stuff. And then and then got back into it more in my university years, you know, sort of early 20s type thing. And then somehow I fell into road biking, and I don't really know. I think it was something to do with moving to San Francisco. And it seemed like all of my friends at that time had road bikes. And eventually I bumped into a friend that was riding a mountain bike, and he said, "Oh yeah, you're pretty fast, dude. You should try this and you should try racing." And so I did, and he was right. And still, even though I had a mountain bike and enjoyed riding that, I was sure that riding the road bike was what was going to make me fast and competitive. And the thing I cared about most of all was my body weight, right? So like I would do anything to try and be skinny, and I would try and do anything to make my bike as light as it possibly could. And I really laugh now when I see some of the pictures of the old bikes I had that weighed, you know, like a full suspension mountain bike that wasn't very expensive, but still only weighed 19 pounds because of the tire choice I've made. You know, it's just completely ridiculous. But, you know, at that time I was really skinny and weak, and my back used to hurt a lot, and it took the fun out of mountain biking. So I know that's kind of a loaded question, but let me ask you this. Why is strength training important for mountain biking?
Well, you know, really at the heart of it is, I mean, really we kind of got to take one step back with, because there's a big difference. Like mountain biking and road cycling are not kind of, you know, different flavors of the same sport. Like I have an article on my blog, like why I hate the term cycling. I really hate the term cyclist, because to lump everybody who rides a bike in as the same kind of athlete, that's like saying ball sport athlete.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, just because you have a ball in your sport, well, that's saying that a golfer and a baseball player and a soccer player and a football, you know what I mean? It's like they
Yeah.
all play with a ball. So therefore there's this general category called ball sport athlete, and we're all just going to kind of lump everybody into that. Like that's ridiculous, and people kind of laugh when you put it that way, but that's exactly what's happened with the term cycling. And that's why so many people get confused as to what is the best way to get better at mountain biking. Because cycling, I mean, we all know it's just a code word for road cycling or road riding. Like that's when someone says cycling or cyclist, that's really what they mean is road riding. And so the problem though is that road riding is a completely different sport than mountain biking is, from our positions, from a metabolic standpoint, from an energy demand standpoint, from a strength demand, skill demands. Like when you start really looking at the sports beyond the fact that we're on something that has two wheels and we pedal to power it, you really start to see like, man, these sports are nothing alike. And so you know, even the bikes that we ride are extremely different. And so there's a lot of confusion because people want to get better at mountain biking, and a lot of the information out there that exists pretty much tells you how to get better at road cycling. And there's this assumption that if you get better at road cycling, then that's going to automatically translate over. But and now we arrive to the point where you found yourself, which is, well, crap, this ain't working. And unfortunately, that's where a lot of people come to me, is that they have spent time, energy, and effort following the traditional ways of trying to get better at mountain biking, which usually involves a ton of road riding. I mean, honestly, we got to be the only group of athletes in the world that are told to practice another sport to get better at your sport. You know what I mean? It's ridiculous. Like road cyclists don't ride on the road. They don't ride their bikes to improve their cardio. They ride their bikes to improve riding on the road. Like for them, that's specific, you know, training. For us, it's general training. So the on the trail, you have a lot more of what I call high tension cardio. And you know, anyone who's been on the trail kind of instinctively knows what I'm talking about when I say high tension cardio. You know, you've got low tension cardio where you're able to kind of sit and spin, and it doesn't really take a lot of tension in the core or the legs to keep the pedals moving. But then you hit a hill, or you hit a technical section where you got to start laying down a little bit more tension on the pedal. So usually when those RPMs start dropping down below like 80 RPM, or you got to stand up you know, maneuver through something where you're not pedaling. I mean, that's another thing. Like pedaling kind of gets overblown. It's an extremely important part of mountain biking, but it's not, you know, the it's not it. You know what I mean? Like what's funny is most people don't realize is the best riders in the world actually pedal the least. And so, and you also look at I know, you know, for people that don't ride downhill, they may dismiss this, but it still goes without saying. You know, we had a guy, Aaron Gwin, who a few months ago won a World Cup downhill race after he broke his chain right out of the gate. He literally won the thing after only pedaling a few times to get out of the gate. He didn't pedal once to get down, and he still won. And what was funny is a few weeks before, I had posted an article on a on Pink Bike, if anybody's in the mountain bike world knows that site. It's, you know, an interesting site. But I'd come across a study that looked on at what is you know, what does it take to be a successful downhill racer. And it was funny because despite them purposefully looking several times to try to prove that pedaling based cardio fitness, especially as you can measure in a lab, is directly related to mountain bike performance, especially in downhill racing, they couldn't make that connection. But what they found was grip strength, endurance had a direct connection towards the performance. And anyone who really understands functional training, there's a guy named Gray Cook with the Functional Movement Screen and Functional Movement Systems, and he has a really popular saying, that the grip is the window to the core. That you can't have a strong grip without having a strong functional core. And so when someone says that, well, you know, grip strength endurance is, you know, been found to be important for mountain biking, well, I read that back to being, well, core train, like core strength. I don't really like the word core training because everything's core training if you do it right. But core strength is extremely important, especially functional core strength and the way that it matters and how you're moving and using it. But anyways, I posted that article and all these people freaking were ripping on me. And then a couple weeks later, he wins a race without pedaling once. And no one seemed to catch the irony. of the whole thing, except for me. But anyways, the point is that, you know, pedaling is an extremely important part, but it's not the only part, especially on the trail. You have a very large skill component, your ability to use momentum properly, to maintain momentum. So that skill element maintains a lot, or requires a lot more mobility and strength. Like, strength is really just stress proof. How stress proof is your movement, right? Like it's nothing. Like, if you can do a bodyweight squat, if you can't even squat, can't even do a bodyweight squat, well, that's no good. We need to fix your mobility first, right? We need to get you to move properly. Now, once you can move properly, how stress proof is that movement? How much stress can you put that movement under before it starts to break down? And that's where strength comes in. That's all strength really is when you do it properly. And so, you know, now you take someone who can do a perfect bodyweight squat, but you know, have them hold a 35 pound kettlebell to do a goblet squat, and their squat form breaks down. Well, they don't have their movement isn't very stress proof. When you get that movement out on the trail and you put it under stress, it's not going to take a whole lot of stress for it to start breaking down and for you to start moving inefficiently again. And inefficient movement wastes energy, and it's also unbalanced. Mm-hmm. And on the trail, balance is everything. So I mean, once you, you know, kind of understand how strength helps stress proof your movement, and that good movement is really what helps you move efficiently. So, you know, people are always worried about, you know, oh, I gotta, you know, add to the size of my gas tank. Like, when people think they're doing cardio training, you know, what they're trying to do is like, I need to add the size of my gas tank. The other way that you can go about this is also to improve your miles per gallon, improve your efficiency. And so strength training really helps with that efficiency side. It helps, it gives your muscles actually access to more fiber. Something that they found is this whole idea of like fast twitch and slow twitch. It's not quite as simple as that, that you actually will cycle through, like, you know, during cyclic endurance events, like running or cycling, your body will shut down to rest certain muscle fibers and activating other muscle fibers and cycle through. And so the stronger you are, the more muscle fibers you have access to in order to do that little cyclical thing. So it actually can directly increase your endurance by giving your body access to more muscle fiber. So, I mean, when you really understand the dynamic nature of mountain biking, and you understand how to improve the human body beyond just the unidimensional approach that most people would take, which is cardio training. Like, if people understood the history of sports science, they'd understand like why cardio training is so important. It's not that cardio training is the most important thing in the world. It was just the first thing they could study. And it's the easiest thing for them to study. And so, you know, so that's why it's been studied the most. It's not necessarily because it's the most important thing that you can possibly do to improve your performance. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but there's so many other things. And for a lot of mountain bikers, improving your high tension capabilities, improving your strength, and you know, which is going to improve those high tension capabilities, is going to have a huge, huge, gigantic impact on your performance. I've had a lot of people tell me that they actually have, you know, spent less time riding doing cardio training. And I mean, let's face it, like, you know, if you got into this to do cardio training, then great. But I got into this to ride my mountain bike. You know what I mean? And so if I can get better results and spend less mind-numbing time on a trainer or out on the road, then I'm going to do it. And that's really what strength training gives you, is it really just fast tracks and that curve that you need to get past, you know, the strength curve, really. Because people forget, just doing your sport is a form of strength training. So eventually, like, someone who's ridden for 10 years, like, they have extremely high levels of sport specific strength, mm-hmm. you know, just from doing the sport. And so, one, if you're not doing things to offset that, like, you're going to run into like movement and you know, other issues that are going to cause overuse injuries and problems down the road. But the thing is that, you know, you can fast track that process through proper strength training. So instead of taking 5 to 10 years to build the levels of specific strength that you need to be able to really enjoy the trail and start, you know, dominating on a different level, you know, you can cut that down dramatically through strength training. Again, you still got to get out on the trail and ride, you know, I'm not never that. That's the most important thing you can possibly do. I mean, if it's, you know, you got to get out on the trail and ride. But yeah, besides that, I mean, you know, you also got to look at, you know, with a training program, the point of a good training program is to fill in gaps. And this is my, I guess, like my last point, and then I'll stop rambling here. But
no, this is good.
You know, the thing that you want to fill in gaps, right? So you want to look at what does my sport already provide me. Now, my training program should try and fill in some of the gaps that it doesn't provide. Mm-hmm. And so when you're out on your mountain bike and you're riding on the trail, what are you already getting plenty of? Cardio. You know, like that is cardio training. It's the most specific cardio training you can possibly do is riding your mountain bike. And so you're out there breathing hard. You're working your cardio system. You're getting plenty of cardio. You know what you're not getting on the trail? Mobility training, strength training, you know, specific movement, you know, as it applies to skills training. Like, so there's things that you're not getting on the trail that you need on the trail. And so, you know, you're not getting enough of it on the trail. I mean, to dramatically improve it. And so, so again, like when you step back and you really just kind of look at things, it's like, man, strength training is just an extremely obvious choice for a mountain biker because we get plenty of cardio already when we're out on our bike. So my training program, the last thing I need to do is add more cardio. So, from a gap standpoint, from a, stress proofing your movement standpoint so that you can maintain your balance and efficiency longer in the rides and under, you know, higher stress, just, you know, all of those things add up to just making a much better mountain biker. And so, yeah, I mean, when you look at all that, it's like, why wouldn't you spend some time doing some strength training? So yeah, there you go.
Yeah, no, that's definitely very consistent with my experience. I can remember when I did my first skills clinic with Lee McCormack, who I know you know, who's been on this podcast. And he rode behind me once on a trail in Marin and was able to keep up with me without pedaling, like just pumping the trail. And he started, yes. And afterwards he said, you're just like exuding energy everywhere. There's like almost sparks coming out of your head. You're pushing all of these watts to try and make up your lack of skills and lack of ability, yes, to pump the trail. And so, yeah, I'm definitely, you can't, you know, it's helpful to have a huge aerobic engine, but as you pointed out, you can't really use that to overcome the other skills that are necessary for mountain biking.
Yeah, you can only do it for so long, you exactly, know, and eventually you will run into that wall. But no, there is a lot of riders out there, unfortunately, that they try to outfitness their way through bad skills. And even then it's like, you know, with the skill stuff, it's, you know, I had one of my great epiphanies at a skills camp, and I'm watching one of the coaches try and help one of the guys get into the proper and just basic body position. It's like day one, lesson one, right? Okay, here's basic body position. And this poor guy was just struggling. And, you know, the coach is doing everything he possibly could to try to get him into like a decent basic attack position. And it just dawned on me all of a sudden. I'm like, I'll bet that guy can't touch his toes.
Right.
And then all of a sudden I'm like, I'll bet that guy can't do a decent hip hinge. Like I couldn't get him in the gym and get him to do a deadlift. So it's like, and that was when I realized that, you know, your skills are intimately tied to how well you move. Right. And that, you know, in my experience of coaching, that high level skills should not be like, obviously there's a difference between picking them up and getting really good at them and mastering them, but you should be able to pick up a skill, a high level skill, in about 10 to 15 minutes without a whole lot of just crazy coaching. And if you haven't been able to pick it up in that amount of time, you're not ready for it. There's some fundamental movement or skill that you do not have that is just not going to work. So if you're trying to learn a kettlebell swing and it takes you more than 10 minutes to be able to really pick it up and be able to snap out some good swings, you're not ready. Your hip hinge was not where it needed to be. You know, and people hate to hear this, especially skills coaches that try to cram everything you need to know into a weekend. And I've been guilty of it. And I tell people right off the bat when I do my skills camps, like, look, you're going to run into your wall. You're going to hit the point where your movement and your strength are what are holding you back, not your knowledge of what to do. Mm-hmm. And you're just going to have to accept it. Like, you're not going to learn how to do everything this weekend. And so, you know, and that's, you know, with the skills, like if you're trying to learn how to corner and man, it's taking you more than 10, 15 minutes to pick up the basics of it and be able to execute it. You are lacking something. There's some movement skill that you're lacking that you need to pick up. So, you know, that's kind of the other bonus is what I've found is that when people move better and they're stronger, their skills kind of automatically improve and they're able to pick up, you know, refinements on their skills so much faster and so much easier. And, you know, 99% of what people are struggling with out there when it comes to skill stuff really just boils down to bad movement and bad and gaps in their strength. And you fix those and man, it's amazing how much better you move on the bike and how a lot of these skills problems that that people have kind of start to clean themselves up a little bit. Right. So, but yeah, no, you're absolutely right, man. Like once you move more efficiently, like if you watch a good rider, like I said, it's like, you know, you can just tell, like they look effortless, mm-hmm. you know, and then you watch, you know, a not so good rider and they look like they're just hacking at the trail. And it's like the problem that we have with mountain biking, there's another article on my blog that I wrote on arete, which is the Greek word for excellence, but with style and grace. And, you know, the Greeks understood that it wasn't enough to just do it. You needed to have some style and grace with it as well, that the really good ones possess that style and grace. And so, you know, especially in athletics that we don't, or with mountain biking, like we don't like put in people's minds, like, man, have some balance, have some style, have some grace. Like, don't worry about how fast you're going. Mm-hmm. Just worry about, and I hate to use the word look like you know what you're doing, because you want to more than look like it. You want to know what you're doing, but you know, you do, you want to have that where someone was to see you riding the trail from across the way, would just see the way that you move on the bike and would be like, oh, that's a good rider, you know, wouldn't even need to see anything else, but you can just tell a good rider when you see one by the way that they move. But again, like I said, the problem is, you know, you can have two riders who have the same Strava times, for example, or finish, you know, similar places in a race series. And they're going to be looked at as like the same rider, but you got one dude who, like, you know, was you who is, you know, sparks coming out of your head to get that, you know, just pedaling your face off and horrible skills and just blowing speed in every corner. But dude, you've got the engine to pedal out of it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And then you got the other guy who's smooth and fluid, and maybe he doesn't have the huge aerobic engine, but he's making use of everything that he's got. And it, man, in my mind, like, I think the guy who's getting there with a little more style and grace is kind of leaning more towards, you know, being more like in the spirit of mountain biking. It's like, you know, I don't know. It's and this is just, you know, where philosophies and stuff. I know we all just kind of need to, you know, hold hands by the fire and sing kumbaya because we're all the same. We're all in the same family, but.
It's an interesting point. And I think the guy that is smoother and more stylish and just does better with the skills is probably also going to be the guy that's more consistent, right? So the guy that's winning the series points, the guy that comes back and does well year after year, rather than the guy that gets, you know, one good result and then crashes and breaks his collarbone and then recovers from that and crashes and breaks something else. And
yeah, we also have the phenomenon of the good local rider. And this is something I tell people, like, you have to make a distinction between a good rider and a good local rider. Because there's people out there that are great local riders. I mean, they know their trails like the back of their hand. They know where to get the pedal strokes in. They know where the corners are coming up. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And you ride with these guys and they're fast. But man, you get them off of their local trails. You get them into something unfamiliar. And all of a sudden, they're either like, you know, just wrecking left and right. Or they have to slow down significantly. You know, these are the guys that are like always, oh, you know, I gotta get used to this new trail before I can rip it or whatever, you know, and they've always got a ton of excuses as to like why they can't, you know, ride quite as fast and at the same level outside of their comfort zone, outside of the trails that they know. And again, that boils down to exactly what you're saying, the more consistent rider. Like if you have authentic skills, then you will be able to apply those authentic skills under any circumstance. Mm-hmm. But if you're just relying on, man, I got really good fitness and I know my local trails like the back of my hand, so I'm going to do really good in my local race series and I'm going to do really good with my local riding group. But, you know, you venture out of those things and all of a sudden you're not really, you know, as good a rider as you thought. And so that's just kind of something else. It's just, it's really with new riders, it's tough because you come in and you don't know who to look up to, you know, like you come in and you're looking up to everyone. And honestly, you can't look up to everyone because not everyone deserves to be looked up to. Not everyone knows what the hell they're talking about and knows how to help you get to that same level either. And so, you know, if you're just judging based solely on Strava times or, you know, who's doing the best in the local race series or, you know, and again, sometimes those two things overlap. Sometimes they are the same person, but you know, people need to understand that there's, definitely it just, and it depends on, you know, what do you want out of riding? You know, if like, if you want to have the smooth style and grace side of it, then, you know, look at what the riders that have that do, kind of thing. But, man, it's such a more consistent ability to apply your skills and have fun. And, you know, that was one of the things that would always frustrate me when I first started riding. It's like, why would Sundays I would go out and I would just be killing it. Just like, oh, this is so awesome. You know, I just love being out here. And I would almost kind of get sad at the end of those rides because I knew that my next ride wasn't going to be that good. You know what I mean? Like just kind of the consistency thing of like, well, why some days am I on the trail, I feel like I'm going to kill myself. And other days I'm like freaking, you know, killing it. I'm doing really well. And for me, it was when I started to realize it all boiled down to like, well, I was moving differently on those bad days. I wasn't moving as well. My balance points weren't as good. So again, as I started to figure out like how all this movement stuff tied into my biking and my performance, my performance got a lot more consistent. I got rid of those quote unquote bad days where you're just like, Jesus, man, I should have just stayed at home today.
Yeah, I've had lots of those.
Yeah. So yeah, man, across the board, it helps you a ton. So I guess my point is there's definitely more than one way to skin a cat. You know, I mean, the way that I'm talking about is not the only way, because you will find guys who are amazingly fast on the trail and they are not very skilled. And I guess my point is just that realize that there's two different ways, that their way isn't the only way either, even though it's the way that's usually emphasized and glorified more than the, like, you know, than like, man, don't try hard. You know what I mean? Cause that's what the skills part is. It's like, don't try hard. Mm-hmm. Don't try to go fast and you'll go fast. The other side is fucking A, go fast, man. You know, freaking sparks coming out of my ears. Kind of thing, you know, so both of them can work, but I found for longevity and consistency and stuff like that and fun that the you know, emphasizing movement and skills and stuff like that definitely helps or works better.
This is good news actually, because you know, I have a lot of doctors on my podcast and they talk about the importance of maintaining lean muscle mass for all types of other reasons. Including Joe Friel, who I had on a couple of weeks ago, talked about the importance of strength training. So, you know, I think most people listening will already be sold on the idea of strength training. But let me ask you this. So I really hate going to the gym. So does that mean I can't be included in this strength training thing?
No, I hate going to the gym too, man. It's a zoo in there. I used to manage a gym for a few years down in Texas, a couple of years, and it was very interesting. You know, again, it's just, you have to start, you know, we used to refer to it as general population and stuff. It's like, man, can we put this out there in a general pop? Are they going to hurt themselves? You know, like it's a, so anyways, yeah, running a gym is an interesting thing, but, man, yeah, gyms, you don't need to be able to go to a gym. When people say strength training again, it's what are we talking about? And it's when you think about strength training as a form of movement practice. And so again, I terms have value, but they also start to become limiting. Like the term cyclist has value, but like I mentioned earlier, it becomes very limiting. And the term strength training, same thing. It has value, but it quickly becomes very limiting for a lot of people because in their mind, strength training equals, you know, heavy weights and lots of equipment and, you know, probably a lot of straining and sweating and you know, maybe some big muscles coming along with it that they don't necessarily want. And so hopefully, you know, most people listen to this podcast, I think it sounds like are a little ahead of the curve, knowing like, oh, you know, you can strength train in a way that's not going to make you big and bulky, and you can strength train in a way that's going to help your sport. But beyond that, it just becomes a matter of, it's like, you know, it's a principle based thing. Like, methods are many, principles are few, methods may change, principles never do. So if you just understand the principles of what you're trying to accomplish. And so the, you know, the human body has got, you know, depending upon who you talk to, I prefer the six basic things. You've got push pull, you've got squat, you've got your hip hinge. Loaded carry, I think, is a huge one. I don't know if you've had a lot of people talking about doing loaded carries. And
no, just explain to me what a loaded carry is.
So loaded carry is the, so if you think about it, one of the things with a lot of the exercises that we do in the gym is we're stationary. It's a dynamic stationary movement, which is an oxymoron. But you know, when you're doing a deadlift, you're not really going anywhere. Or you're doing a squat, you're not really going anywhere.
Right.
You're lifting weight up and down. But out in the real world, is I call it, you know, because the gym can produce zoo humans, you know, like you can get some really cool gym tricks down, and they still don't transfer over to the real world as much as a lot of these functional training.
Right. Bench like press.
Bench press, or even again, like, so let's say that you can deadlift twice your body weight, right? Which is like that upper benchmark that I usually give people. Like, man, when you can deadlift twice your body weight and it not be the hardest thing in the world that you've done, that you're strong. Strength is probably not, like, strength in the hip hinge is not one of your issues. But now you've got to grab 250-pound buckets and carry it across your yard, and you're just struggling. You're like, what the frick? You know what I mean? It's like, I can deadlift 3-4 times this amount. Like, why and so that transfer of from that kind of stationary to actually moving with weight and having to handle load while you're moving rather than you, you know, kind of staying still and moving with the weight. But anyway, so the, so loaded carries are things like farmer's walks, you know, people have watched the strongman competitions. You've seen the dudes like grab the big heavy things and walk as far as they can. Like, that's the traditional one. So you've got your farmer's walk where you've got the weights down at your side. You've got like your rack walk. If you're familiar with a kettlebell training, that's the rack position up at the chest where you hold the kettlebells, you know, before you know, doing shoulder presses and stuff like that. Overhead as well. So those are your three main positions. Then you can do two arms at a time, or you can do one arm at a time in any of those three positions. And then you can start mixing them up. So I can hold one down at my side in the farmer's walk and hold one over my head, or hold one in the rack and one in the farmer. So, you know, you just between those three positions, you got like a huge amount of different combinations that you can put together. And then you can start throwing in, if you have access to a sandbag or something like that. So doing like a bear hug where you bear hug the sandbag and carry it, shouldering it, putting the bag on your shoulder and walking with it. So really, you know, even if anybody does sled stuff like pushes and pulls on sleds, all of those things kind of fall into the loaded carry category. And it's really, like I said, it's just kind of, you know, working on that skill of you being able to move under load. And so it really teaches you one, like high tension breathing, which is something that's extremely important for us on the trail. Your ability to breathe properly under tension is huge. And I mean, that's what's going to make the difference between you gassing, you know, before you get to the top of that hard hill and making it over it. You know, if you understand how to breathe properly under tension and you're able to oxygenate your blood and all that stuff better, then you're going to be better under those situations. And again, these are tough things to train necessarily on the bike or through traditional cardio training methods. So loaded carries are really good for that. But again, if you're not doing those are like this miracle thing, especially for mountain bikers, because for us, we think about core training, but the core is like your, you know, it's not just your abs. It also includes your upper back. Like, your core is, if you cut off your head, arms, and legs, that's your core. And so the upper back is kind of the forgotten area of the core that we don't really think about. Like you'll see people doing planks and they got, you know, perfect form, but you'll see this horrendous rounded shoulder posture and stuff going on. And it's like, well, you're missing, you know, the whole thing there. But the, so that's a big area that of weakness for us as mountain bikers, like our ability, that upper back area, that ability to maintain our shoulders back and down on the bike. Because again, we just give into this crap. We think like, oh, that's just normal. You just have to have that rounded shoulder posture. It's like, no, you don't. You don't have to have that. You can do the things to combat that. And that rounded shoulder posture is terrible for you. One, it throws off your balance on the bike. Again, just going back to basic balance. You literally cannot breathe properly when you have your shoulders rounded forward like that. You can't access the top part of your lungs. You're cutting off how much oxygen you can take in. So again, like without cardio training, if I can get you to improve your posture and improve some basic breathing habits under load, you're going to have better cardio and endurance on the trail without ever doing a single interval or anything. You know what I mean? So that's the other thing, is there's so many different ways to attack this idea of endurance and cardio without just looking at pedaling as the main way to do it. But yeah, the loaded carries are amazing for the upper back and the posture aspect that that so many of us need to work on. So for mountain bikers, man, that's like one of those miracle things. If you're not doing them and all of a sudden I get you doing some loaded carries, all of a sudden I look like a genius a few weeks later. It's like, you're like, man, I'm feeling better and moving better and performing better. And it's like, yeah, dude, I'm a genius. But man, yeah, just that simple. So that's loaded carries. That's one that a lot of people miss when they're looking at putting their workouts together. And you know, they may throw something like that in every once in a while, but very few people actually do that every workout. So I'm a big believer in, if it's important, the old Dan Gable saying, if it's important, do it every day. If it's not important, don't do it at all. So is it important that we squat every day? Is it important that we hip hinge, that we push, that we pull, that we do the loaded carry? You know, and then I fall into the Dan John camp with the movements, and he has what he calls the sixth movement or everything else. And it's kind of the, you know, you could look at this as like the core stuff. You know, if you're needing some specific core work, you need to do some single leg work, or it's kind of like, well, what do you need to work on? Mm-hmm. Like what's kind of one of your specific gaps? And then that's what we're going to put in there. And I personally like to put things like the windmill and the stick windmill in there, which are two great exercises that don't get nearly enough play and enough use in people's programs, especially mountain bikers, man. That's like cornering. If you can't do a stick windmill and you can't do a kettlebell windmill, good luck cornering properly. Because that is the body movement, that corkscrew movement that you do to perform a kettlebell windmill is the exact same movement that you need to be able to execute on your bike to corner properly. So I mean, that's the, you know, just the looking at what the, you know, the six movements. And then, so with that in mind, you know, your original question was like, do I need to go to the gym? And I guess like, well, we can find things that you can do outside of the gym that help you push. You can do a push-up. You can do a pull-up. You can have, you know, you can your squats and hinges. I mean, all of these things, these are principles. Now I can figure out what method I'm going to use to work on these things. And that's where, well, okay, you can have a kettlebell, a single kettlebell, and you can get a great workout with it. You can have a single dumbbell. You can have just body weight. You start to get limited with body weight. I think body weight stuff gets a little, you know, overblown. It's extremely important, but this idea that all you need is body weight forever is not, you know, 100% accurate. Yeah, so you don't have to go to the gym. You can have very minimal equipment. In fact, one of my favorite tools I've been playing around with lately, I just did a blog post on it yesterday, is the steel mace, which is an amazing tool. I mean, and I don't even think they'll let you in a gym with that thing. I guarantee you they'd kick you out if you started came in there with that thing. They think it's a weapon. It is. It's a weapon. It would look like it could, you know, came off of a medieval battlefield. But it's a super fun training tool. But again, like I got a 10-pound mace, and sometimes I'll just go out in my yard with this 10-pound mace and I'll get a great workout in with just that. And so, no, you definitely don't need to go to the gym. You don't have to have access to all this equipment. If you understand the principles of what you're trying to accomplish, then it's really easy to figure out, well, what methods do I have access to? And if it's just my body weight, fine. Well, I'll figure out, okay, push, a pull, a squat, a hinge, you know, and so it's not, yeah, you don't need a whole lot of fancy stuff or fancy equipment, or definitely don't need to go to the gym.
I will link to these. If you've been listening to this and these exercises that James has been mentioning, I will link to these in the show notes so you can find them easily. And I was just thinking, yeah, I have all of those things. I have a sandbag already that I haven't touched in a long time. And then I was also thinking, I have a child, right? And she weighs about 35 pounds. And
yes.
You could do a loaded carry with a child, or even two kids would be probably pretty good.
That's the original loaded carry, man. You know, like we've, and this is just kind of getting maybe a little off subject, but there's a huge epidemic that I've recently become aware of, because I realized that I was part of the epidemic myself and part of the problem in some ways. And I've got to work on becoming part of the cure. But we have a society full of zoo humans. Like, you know, they can perform a couple cool tricks, but you get them outside of this, you know, basic comfort zone. Like most people, you know, couldn't, I guess how this thing, like, you know, the idea is before a modern society came along, like we had to do a lot of things on a consistent basis. And a lot of us, we lose the stuff. Like, how many adults do you know that can throw with accuracy with both arms still?
Right. Yeah.
You know, like, how many adults do you know that could hang from a tree branch for 30 seconds?
Yeah. Yeah.
No. Or even like for, you know, so just these basic skills that, like, it seems, you know, we're like, man, in our modern society, we don't need to be able to do that. But the problem is that you're actually creating, like, you know, underlying issues that you don't realize are there. Like, the fact that you can't throw isn't just the fact that you can't throw. Like, there's like movement and structure issues that are keeping you from being able to throw. And those are going to be able, those are going to come back to haunt you down the road. So trying to keep an eye on not becoming a zoo human, and athletics is about being a zoo human. You know what I mean? It's a really cool trick, man. Being able to ride a bike really mm-hmm. fast, really far is a really cool trick. The analogy that I use is this, that, you know, if I needed someone, if I got hurt and I needed someone to run or ride a bike a real far ways away and then come back and help me, then I would want a marathon runner or I would want a cyclist. But they're going to be worthless if a freaking rock fell on me and I need them to help pick it up off of me before I get crushed. But then you flip that to a power lifter. Well, I'm going to want that dude there if the rock fell on me, but, you know, good luck if I need someone to go run for help and make it back in a reasonable amount of time. So that's kind of a really good kind of example of how someone who's really fit in like one area is still a little bit of a zoo human. You know what I mean? Like, if you couldn't pick something up off of somebody, not, you know, the ways that, you know, this is where the double body weight deadlift comes in. Like, people that can't body weight, you know, deadlift their own body weight. Well, dude, if someone that weighed your own weight was in trouble in a burning house and you needed to pull them to safety, like, they're probably screwed. Like, uh-huh. You probably won't be able to do that for them now. And so again, people are like, ah, it's ridiculous, but it's like, man, this is, you know, you never know when this stuff's going to happen. And two, it's like, it's just kind of sad that as humans, we lose these innate, you know, beautiful abilities that we were born and blessed with. And we just let them deteriorate. And we look at these narrow little niches of fitness and say, well, that's, you know, that's it. You know, if I can ride a bike really far and really fast, then that's what matters. It doesn't matter that I can't throw, I can't jump, I can't run, I can't swim. You know what I mean? And it's like, that's not good. That is not good for us to get to that point. So yeah, man, I mean, that's the thing is, like, kids, the reason we got to do loaded carries in the gym is because we don't carry our kids as much as we used to. We don't carry things around as much as we used to. So now we got to pretend to do that crap in the gym.
Right.
And so it's, but yeah, but understanding that, like, man, the gym, you still have to do things like, you know, purposefully going on, you know, hikes and not taking your stroller or you know, going to the mall and like carrying your kid. You know what I mean? Like
yeah.
Thinking of ways, like, how do I use this fitness in a real life situation instead of, like, you know, it's like you people have probably seen this freaking picture. You've got the escalator. Where right, people are riding up the escalator to go to the gym. You know right. what I mean? The gym's at the next level up and they're riding the escalator to go to the gym. But it's kind of the same thing. If we're in the gym and you're doing farmer's walks, and then you go to the grocery store for a short trip and you make sure that you've got the stroller for your kid because you don't want to have to carry them, there's a freaking disconnect there, people. There's a disconnect there.
Yeah.
So anyways, I guess like my point is that, yeah, man, you can do anything. And if you become aware of not becoming a zoo human and finding ways to challenge your innate human abilities on a more consistent basis, just, it's just going out. And like, I've been taking my daughter on what I call jungle runs, man. They're fun. We go out this little overgrown area near my house, and man, we're like, crawling around and following deer trails and hanging on trees and throwing rocks and lifting stones over our heads. And it's just, as kids, we used to call it playing. And, you know what I mean? But that's what we were made to do. And that's what we, need to do. And so, trying to encourage people to get out of these narrow little boxes that we put ourselves in. It's like, we got the gym and we've got our bikes, and it's like, man, just go out on a freaking hike. And instead of following the path, just say, I'm going over there, and go. And, obviously make sure you're not breaking any laws and trespassing on private property and stuff like that. But man, it's just, just get outside of our freaking little comfortable little society every once in a while and actually use this stuff. And you start to discover some really, really interesting things about fitness. Like, squatting, man, squatting is all about getting your butt low and being able to keep your eyes still on the horizon. It's not a power move. Like, you're not squatting hundreds of pounds out in the woods. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it's like, well, if I can squat all this weight, but you can't squat down low and be able to kind of walk around and maneuver down in that position down low, that's a zoo human trick, So anyways, it's like I said, a little off subject, but just kind of something for people to keep in mind that as they're thinking about this stuff and training, like, remember, man, we're not mountain bikers. We're human beings that ride mountain bikes. We're not whatever fill in the blank. It's like, we are human beings first that do whatever that is. And we've got to keep an eye on the human being rather than just focus on that end product so much.
It's really interesting to hear you talk like this, because you sound a lot like Katie Bowman, who has also been on the podcast. She's a biomechanist, and she's of exactly the same opinion. She persuaded me to get rid of my stroller a long time ago. Your parents think they're doing you a favor by buying you one of these things, but they're really not. And
where is she? Okay, that name sounds familiar. What is she?
Katie Bowman. She has a book called, I believe it's called Movement Matters. I'll link to this in the show notes, because I can't recall it. But she's really brilliant. She's a very minimalist everything. Her house has got no furniture in it. And
I swear, I think I know who she is, man. I think I heard her on the Joe Rogan podcast.
Yeah, quite possibly.
Okay, yeah. And she had a great comment that I use on people all the time. We're the weird ones because we have couches in our living room. Like, we think that people that don't have a couch in their living room are weird. But when you look at the amount of, like, the number of people in the world that don't have a couch in their living room versus the number of people that do, we're the weird ones. So, yeah, no, she was actually, it's been really interesting how different things come into your life that all kind of keep pointing you in a direction.
Yeah, exactly. And, I'm sensing a theme here. Yeah, so yeah, Katie's original book was called Alignment Matters, which was really just the first 5 years of her blog. And the new book is called Move Your DNA. Which is an excellent book too. I'd highly recommend it. Yeah, so we better talk about flat pedals then, because flat pedals is, I feel like, so your strength training programs and listening to you speak, and then in particular, the philosophical stuff that we've just been talking about, I think has been really helpful for me in enabling me to get better on the mountain bike. I've upgraded to pro. I'm doing pretty good right now. And I'm sure that the strength is a big part of it. But I'm also sure that the flat pedals, particularly on the mountain bike, were instrumental in helping me improve my skills. Like, before, I was just riding around and I didn't have the weight on my feet a lot of the time. And I think this is a deadly sin for mountain biking. And you soon find out when you start riding flat pedals, you find out pretty quick whether your weight's on your feet or not. And so where do the flat pedals fit into your training philosophy?
Yeah, it's the flat pedals basically fall into my training philosophy because I believe that natural movement trumps everything else. That trying to One of the biggest lies that the cycling industry, to use that term again, ever got us to believe is that riding a bike is quote unquote different. And I'm sure we've all heard this where people are like, oh, you know, riding a bike is different somehow. And it's like somehow like all the rules of movement get thrown out the window as soon as you throw a leg over your bike. And it's just like, well, you know, we can make up whatever we want. And it's like, no, let's take a step back and look at like how the human body optimally moves. Now, how do we apply that to the bike? And unfortunately, when you do that, you start to see some very different things, come up with some very different ideas than what we're traditionally told from the cycling world. And we forget that a lot of what we're told from the cycling world, it was literally theories that were created by guys in bowler hats and handlebar mustaches over 100 years ago. When the safety cycle, which is what we know as the bicycle, was first invented. Like most people don't realize, like, man, what we know as the bicycle has only been around since the late 1800s, like 1880s, 1890s is when they created the what we know as the modern bicycle. And so when it was created, people did their best to try and come up with ideas on, well, how do we power this thing? And how do we, you know, and they came up with these good ideas and they couldn't really test them, but they sounded good. And so they just got repeated so many times that we all just started taking them for fact. And unfortunately, though, like I said, when you start digging into the actual science and stuff, you start to find some very different things. And so you have to, first of all, you have to kind of walk back a little bit. It's like, well, why, when people tell you that you need clipless pedals, they'll usually say things like, well, it helps you pedal more efficiently. It'll help you climb better. You can, you know, pull up on the backstroke, you know. And so we're given these reasons for why we need to wear clipless pedals. But when you start to ask, like, okay, that's great, but what do you mean exactly? Like, where's the proof? Like, where, when you say pedal more efficiently, what exactly does that mean? And you start to get some, you know, blank stares back from people when you actually start following some of these statements up with questions. And so, so really, I don't know, man, it's this huge giant freaking ball of wax that is, it's just gotten to this point that it's so hard to know where to start with people. But at the end of the day, the way that I try to explain it to people is that the science, there's no science out there that supports the idea of pulling up on the backstroke. Like, as a cycling community, mountain bikers, road riders, everybody, at some point we have got to move past this outdated theory of pulling up on the backstroke. The Morneau and Korff efficiency studies didn't back that up. I have EMG readings that show that that's not what happens. There was a video I'm sure you probably saw. Everybody got, you know, was it Global Cycling Network?
Right, I did whatever. Watch that video.
Yeah. So we had a guy who literally was trying to prove that you needed to pull up on the backstroke by clipping in and pulling up on the backstroke and doing his thing. And then they put him on flats. And man, I don't know if you almost like fell out of your chair when you saw what flats they were putting him on.
Yeah, he was wearing his clipless pedals, wasn't he?
Yes, he was wearing his clipless pedal shoes with some crappy cheap flats. It's like, how on earth is this a fair comparison? But then at the end of the day, he was actually more efficient on the flats because he couldn't pull up on the backstroke. Uh-huh. The flats forced him to pedal properly. And that's what people get lost, is it's not a either or. It's that you need to use flats to develop your skills and your pedal stroke. And then you can use clipless pedals to enhance your good technique, if you even decide that you need to go to clipless pedals. Because that's the problem, is that once you ride flats for a while and you get good on flats, you realize that the performance advantages that are attributed to clipless pedals really are not there. They're nowhere near as huge as people make you, as people lead you to believe. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if you even decide to go to clipless pedals, the idea is you still want to use the same pedal stroke and technique. And so the way that again, it's, you have to get past the clipless pedals don't allow you to use your legs differently. Like this is the hard part to get people to understand is because they have been led to believe for so long that clipless pedals actually allow you to use your legs differently, right? Like you can't pull up on the backstroke if your feet aren't attached to the pedals. And so it's that ability to use your muscles differently than they can on flats that the cycling world has attributed the difference in performance to. But like I said, when you actually look at the science, you see, well, that's not where the differences are coming from, that you actually want to pedal the same way, whether you're on flats or clipless, that the idea of pulling up on the backstroke results in less power and less efficiency has been, you know, there's not one lick of evidence that points in the other direction. Mm-hmm. Everything that's out there points in the direction of don't pull up on the backstroke. Nothing points in the other direction. And yet I'm the crazy one, right? I've got actual science on my side, but somehow I'm the crazy one.
Right. And then, so I could link to these in the show notes, actually. There's two studies in particular. So James has a flat pedal manifesto PDF document, which is very good, actually. I'll link to that in the show notes. But there's two citations in particular, which I think are really good studies. And Tommy Wood, who's been on my podcast a few times, is a research scientist that knows how to read science. And he was also convinced by this idea. And I think it makes intuitive sense. I've realized that the nomenclature here is confusing for people that might not be experienced mountain bikers. So when we say clipless pedals, we mean pedals with clips. It's super confusing. So the type with, you know, these SPD type pedals where your foot actually attaches to the pedal. So that's what we mean when we say clipless. The word clipless refers to the fact that there's no cage going over your foot, which was another type of pedal that nobody really uses anymore. And then, so these flat pedals, there's nothing attaching your foot to the pedal at all. It's just a shoe, just a normal sort of tennis style looking shoe, but hopefully it's got grippy rubber on the bottom of it.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I think this makes intuitive sense. And this is what Tommy, we posted something on my blog and we got a lot of heat for it. Maybe I should link to this too, so you can read it because it's kind of fun. But so basically it makes intuitive sense when you think about how hard you can push with your quads versus how hard you can pull with your hamstring, right?
Like
there's an enormous imbalance there.
Yeah, well, basically what they found is that you pedal your bike the same way that you run, walk. There's basically lower body locomotion. There's a way that your body creates lower body locomotion, and we want to apply that to the bike. So again, a lot of the cycling coaches and stuff, unfortunately, don't understand the dynamics of the human organism. And so, for example, we have these things called passive mechanics. Like, we're not a dumb machine, you know, like we come pre-wired with certain ways to move. And so, for example, these passive mechanics that I just referred to, when you extend hard with one hip, it automatically triggers the opposite hip flexor to fire to pull the other leg up. So this is automatically happening without you thinking. And what's happening, your body is just pulling the leg up hard enough to get it in a position so that it can push, which, like you said, that is our power movement, is pushing, extending our joints is where our power comes from. And so when you're pedaling, same thing, you're just trying to pull up hard enough. You know, people are like, oh, you're not pulling up on the backstroke. It's like, no, you need to pull up on the backstroke. You're just not trying to over pull. You don't need to pull harder than what your body automatically has you do. That if you just focus on pushing down hard, that triggers the other hip flexor to fire and automatically pull your leg up. This is just how the body is made to work. You don't have to think about it. And what's funny is they've shown, you know, cycling, man, I hate to say it, but we are so, like, the cycling world leads the sports world in doping and is probably one of the furthest behind when it comes to actual like training science and application of it to what we're doing. Like when you look at the running world and where they're at with this stuff, it's mind-boggling. But they have done extensive studies on trying to change people's running stride. And they have found that whenever you try to have someone consciously manipulate and change their running stride, that you screw them up, that you make them less efficient and slower. And that the best way to fix someone's running stride is, surprise, surprise, have them run. Have them run. You want to have them be functionally fit, because what you don't want is someone trying to overcome a movement or strength dysfunction through bad form. So if you're doing the things that make sure that you move well and you have the, you don't have any strength gaps and you just run, your body's going to naturally develop the running stride that works best for it. And trying to mess with it is, I mean, very few high level running coaches will purposefully try to manipulate people's running strides like that anymore. And yet we still have the cycling world being told that we need to, you know, concentrate on the four parts of the pedal stroke. You've got to, you know, push over the top and pull here and put, you know, and it's like, wait a minute. Like all the science coming out of the running world shows us that like, you can't do that. You can't consciously change someone's pedal stroke or running stride for the better. And when you understand that this stuff applies to the bike as well, that these rules don't change just because we're on a bike, it just reinforces this idea of like why pulling up on the backstroke doesn't work in the real world and in the labs, because you're having to consciously change what you naturally do, which doesn't work. It doesn't work. So anyways, I mean, obviously there's a fine line. I mean, you can obviously coach somebody, you know, a little bit to clean up, some minor technique flaws and stuff like that. But when you're talking like gross motor pattern changes, like, man, I need you to completely, you know, forget about pushing and I need you to pull, you know, like that is, like I said, nothing backs that up. Outside of tradition, like once you get outside of the echo chamber that is the cycling world, you really start to learn some pretty interesting things that go completely against what we've been telling people to do. But So
tell me about your flat pedals then. So what was it that, you know, I've been using flat pedals for years and getting good results with them and really enjoying the comfort of them, if nothing else. So what was it that you saw with the existing flat pedals that were on the market that made you think I need to make a better one?
Well, you know, it really was a, I'll tell you, man, it's funny. I was thinking about that this morning. And we all do this, man. We all suspend disbelief. Anyone who's ridden clipless pedals has suspended disbelief at some point in their life. You know what I mean? Like you're like, this isn't right, but everyone tells me that it is. So I need to do it this way. And it's kind of the same thing, originally with pushing through the ball of the foot. And as a strength coach, I never have people push through the ball of the foot in the gym. You know what I mean? And I just kind of had to suspend my disbelief a little bit because, well, that's what everybody says to do. And that's what the cyclists do. And that's what the best in the world do. So I'm going to suspend my disbelief and I'm going to push through the ball of the foot when I'm pedaling my bike. But my problem is I kept thinking like, well, why am I training my foot to do something different in the gym than what I'm doing on the bike? And so I kind of naturally started to migrate to a more of a midfoot pedaling position because there was a couple things that came up. One, there was a guy, I did an interview with a guy named Greg Choate. And he pointed out, he was the first guy to point out to me that, well, you know, your foot doesn't break contact with the pedal, right? And I'm like, well, yeah. And he's like, well, that means that you want your foot to be midfoot. Your foot acts differently depending upon whether it stays in contact with what it's on or whether it comes off of what it's on. So if it comes off of what it's in contact with, like if you're running, jumping, anything like that, then you do want to push through the ball of the foot. But if you're in the gym and you're doing deadlifts or you're just sitting down into a chair or you're bending down to pick up your kid, your foot is not breaking contact with the ground or what it's on. Mm-hmm. In those cases, what do? If you have been in the gym, you've had a trainer yell at you, I'm sure, keep your heels on the ground. Don't come up on your toes, right? Well, why in the gym are we told, like, don't come up on the balls of your feet? If pushing through the balls of your feet is better and stronger, then how come in the gym, you know, that's not what we do? And that he was the first guy to point out that difference. I'd never actually realized that the lower leg acted differently depending upon that scenario. And so all of a sudden I'm like, well, yeah. So I started using the midfoot pedal position, more. And, you know, again, you're able to recruit your hips better. There's actually a couple studies that I found, in this whole process. One study looked at the midfoot versus the ball of the foot pedaling position. And their theory was, because there was some study that came out a few years ago that show that 7.5% of your pedaling power is coming from the calf muscle pushing and pulling, that you were going to lose that 7.5% with the midfoot position. So they were setting out to prove that this midfoot position was actually inferior. And what they found was that there was no difference in power or economy. So you basically, you didn't lose any performance. But what was interesting was they found that the stress shifted. When you're on the ball of your foot, the stress is on the Achilles tendon and the calf. And anyone who's had plantar fasciitis or Achilles tendonitis or just like really tight calves or anything like that can probably nod their head and say, yeah, I can feel that tension there. When you move to the midfoot, the tension moves to the hips. So you remove the excess stress from the more sensitive calf and ankle joint, and you move it to the hips. And which is really interesting with another study I found that shows that the hips are the main driver of the pedal stroke at all intensities. So basically this idea that the quads are the most important muscle and they're the driver of the pedal stroke is not true. At any intensity, your hips are always the main driver of the pedal stroke. So it would just kind of seem to me that the science, that if you take these two things together, that if the midfoot position optimally recruits the hips and the hips have been shown to be the main driver of the pedal stroke, wouldn't that seem to indicate that the science would favor a midfoot position? So again, it's kind of funny. Like when you actually take a step back from this echo chamber and you objectively look at the science and what we actually know, you're like, dude, we're pedaling all wrong. And so once you move that midfoot position, it starts to change some dynamics with your foot. But the problem is, if you want to optimize that midfoot position, you have to stabilize both ends of the arch. And this is what led me to my pedal that I created. Was I can still remember it clear as day. I'm sitting on the trail and I'm pissed off at my shoes and my pedals. And I'm like, man, I am tired of, finding the right spot, and then one little thing knocks it out of whack, and I got to get my foot back in the right spot. And I just, my feet don't feel as strong and supported as I wish that they were. Like, why do my strong, stable feet turn into an unstable, unbalanced mess on the bike? And all of a sudden it just hit me, because, in the gym, literally what I thought, the thought that went through my head was, why don't I need stiff-soled shoes to squat and deadlift in the gym? Why can I expose my feet to hundreds and hundreds of pounds of stress in the gym? Way more stress than they see on the bike. And yet they remain strong and stable. And as soon as I get on my bike, they're unbalanced and unstable. Why is that? And it just hit me, because the ground supports both ends of the arch of your foot. The arch is one of the strongest forms in nature, as long as you support both ends. This is why they tell you don't come up on your toes in the gym, because as soon as you come up on your toes, you are destabilizing the arch. You make it harder to recruit the hips, but you also destabilize the arch, which makes it harder to transfer force into the ground. And so and I just realized that because every pedal out there has been designed from the assumption that you need to push through the ball of the foot, even though we know that that's not the case, that's why none of the pedals actually provided that platform. And so I realized that I was going to have to make it. So I went home and measured my foot and realized that about 5 inches long, I'd be able to get my big toe knuckle and my heel on the ground. So I'd be able to push through my whole foot. So it feels just like it, when you stand on these pedals, it feels like you're standing on the ground. You don't have that kind of moment of sensational shift, where your feet are getting used to being on pedals, and then you get off your pedals and your feet are getting used to being on the ground. It's like, that doesn't happen, because your foot recognizes the stability of this pedal as being the same type of stability that it gets on the ground. And so, so once you get that position, man, it just changes everything with the pedal stroke. So now you get no flex out of your foot, right? So your arch doesn't flex, and you're also not getting flex out of the ankle, because you've got this midfoot position. You don't have this long lever that you're trying to control with the pedal being out on the ball of the foot, and your poor ankle working like hell to try to counteract that leverage. So you're getting no flex out of the foot, and you're not pushing forward into the toe box anymore. Now your foot's actually level And people, I just want to make sure people understand, like, this doesn't mean you can't shift your weight to your toes or to your heels still. You can still shift your weight forward and back. It's just now you actually have the option of a true neutral. You're not on your toes or have your heel dropped. You know, usually on the bike, you're at one of two extremes. And so when you're on your toes, you're constantly pushing forward into the toe box. So this does two things. One, this is where you get your numb toes from. Numb toes and sore feet, that's coming from those toes being shoved into the toe box with every pedal stroke and every time you stand up. The other thing that this does is you're literally pushing forward and trying to kick your foot off of your pedal. And this is one of the reasons that people kind of gravitate towards clipless pedals, especially at first, is because they have a hard time keeping their feet on the pedals. And that's because their weight is biased to their toes and they're literally trying to kick their feet off their pedal. So as soon as you get your foot stabilized, you get a good, strong midfoot position, as you come over the top of the pedal stroke, you're not leading with your toe. You're able to come over and actually drive down with your whole foot, your heel and the ball of the foot. So that completely changes the forces going into the pedal, which gets rid of like almost all of that over the top sensation that you get sometimes where your feet feel like they want to fly off the pedals, especially in like rough, choppy stuff, if you're trying to pedal through that. So yeah, that was kind of my inspiration and my idea. And, you know, I realized throughout this journey that, I hate to say it, but clipless pedals aren't better than flats. Just our flat pedals are a shitty design. And that once you get a good flat pedal design, that, man, it really bridges a lot of those gaps. Like, I would put these pedals up against a pair of clipless pedals and they may not win in a power meter contest, but they're not going to lose, you know? And when you add in the fact that you've got the freedom of flats and you've got the comfort that you can't get from any other pedal out there because you're not shoving my toes never go numb anymore. It's amazing. I was one of those things that I didn't even think about. And if I was just out on like a long ride with my prototypes, you know, about the time when you're usually like, dude, my feet are starting to get a little, you know, my pinky toes going numb or whatever. And I realized like, man, my feet feel great. And it took me a little bit to realize what was going on, but that's when I realized, like, that's because I'm not shoving my toes into my toe box all the time. So, man, as you can tell, I'm pretty excited about it. I mean, I personally think that this pedal is going to really change a lot of people's minds about, you know, the whole flats versus clipless thing. And I think that we actually have a flat pedal now that from a really doesn't have any drawbacks to it, and it just comes down to changing how the foot interacts. I mean, when I work with people in the gym and I tell them, like, all right, everything that we do boils down to three areas: feet, hips, shoulders. Same thing on the bike: feet, hips, shoulders. If your feet are balanced, if your hips are where they need to be, if you're feeling the tension in your glutes and the top of your hamstrings, not in the lower back or in like the belly of the hamstring, if your shoulders are where they need to be, you're feeling the tension in the upper back, you're not, you know, the shoulders aren't hunching up towards the ears, like some of these basic principles, if you can apply these basic principles to these three areas, to any skill or any exercise that you want to do, you're going to do it pretty darn good. And so again, it's one that I coach balance on the feet being such an important aspect of movement, and yet none of the pedals on the market allow you to achieve a truly balanced position on the foot. And that's what the Catalyst pedal does, is finally gives us a pedal that's going to allow your foot to interact with a surface that's actually like what it's designed to thrive on and not leave it like unstable and unbalanced. So, right.
So the pedal is actually longer than a normal flat pedal.
Yeah. It's 5 inches from front to back. Your normal flat pedal is about 3 3/4 inches. So it's it gives you an inch of contact space.
Oh, wow.
On the top. And it's no wider than a normal flat though. And this is one of the things that always pissed me off about the other oversized flats out there, is whenever they made them longer, none of them get to the 5 inches that mine are. They also make them wider.
And then you clip them on everything.
And you clip them on everything.
I've tried that, yeah.
God, it blows my mind, dude. I know. Like, I can't ride oversized flats where I ride because of the rock clipping problem. And so, So I designed these things with that in mind. They're longer to support your foot, but they're no wider, so you're not exposing any extra pedals to rock strikes or anything like that. So they completely disappear under your foot. Like when you step on them, they're gone. Like you don't look down and see any bits of them poking out somewhere. And yeah. So, and I tested the crap out of these things, man. Dirt jumps, downhilling, cross country riding, took them to Moab, rode the whole enchilada on them. I've had, you know, experienced riders try them, new riders try them. And I mean, I can't find anything that I would change on these things, man. Like they are, you know, there's not an increase in rock strikes. There's nothing. I was talking to someone about this the other day. There's no situation where I'm like, it's a little bit of a trade-off, you know, like it's better in 99.9% of the situations, but there's this one little spot over here where it may not quite be as good. There's nothing. There's never been that spot. It's either as good as a normal pedal or better. So, I'm pretty pumped on it, man. I think.
I'm excited. I've ordered mine. I'm excited to get them. So why don't you tell people where they can get these pedals?
Yeah. You can find out more at pedalinginnovations.com. That's the name of the company. The Catalyst pedal is the name of the pedal, but yeah, it's pedalinginnovations.com. Has got more info. I've got a bunch of the science stuff that I was referring to here linked there. I mean, in all honesty, these are the only pedals on the market that are backed by actual science, people. Like every other pedal out there is backed by nothing but marketing hype and theories. There's no actual science to back up what, like, you think the SPD pedal was based on science? You know what I mean? No, it was based on engineering. They engineered that sucker. You know, so again, this is the only pedal that actually has science kind of pointing in the direction of saying, you know, that guy might be right. So, and I do back them up with a 30-day money back guarantee. So I know it's winter right now and whatnot. So it's really just kind of a money back guarantee. But I'm fully confident if anybody tries these pedals. The only thing is, you got to be open to changing your foot position. I will say I've had a few people who weren't blown away by the pedal. Like 80% of people who've tried it were just like blown away. They're like, holy crap, man, that's amazing. And the other people were like, oh, that's pretty good. But they were the people who just would not stop pushing through the ball of their foot, man. There were a couple of them that just drove me nuts. It's like, no matter what I told them, it's just the ball of the foot was still over the top of the axle. And if you're not willing to change your foot position a little bit, and yes, it does take a ride or two to get used to, but people got to remember, you watch kids ride. Kids use a midfoot pedaling position. You're not having to learn a new pedaling position. You're just remembering one that you forgot because when you got older, somebody told you that you didn't know how to do it right.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, so, no, I'm lucky I don't fall into that category because I look at the wear pattern on the bottom of my 510s and it's smack bang in the middle of the shoe. It's not, for some reason I haven't, even though I ride clipless a lot too, it hasn't really worn off on me.
Yeah. Well, because again, you have to consciously think about it. And you know, if you just naturally ride, your foot will go to that midfoot position. And so, yeah, if you're not consciously trying to override it, then you won't. But that's the thing. That's, you know, the people that are really hardcore, because I, you know, one of my buddies is like, man, this is what I've learned to do. It's what I've trained myself to do. And I'm just like, man, that's like coming into the gym, though, and showing me how you deadlift and me saying like, hey, man, you shouldn't use your lower back so much. Like, you know, try it a little bit differently. And yeah, it's going to feel a little weird at first and you might not be able to lift as much weight. But then you turn around and tell me like, I'm just going to keep using my lower back. I don't really care. You know, so it's like, I understand that that's what you know. And I understand that you feel like that's what helps you perform better. But the reality is pushing through the ball of the foot has no advantages over the midfoot position. And it actually, I can make several arguments about disadvantages that it has. And so if you're open-minded and you're willing to try something different and give it a couple rides, because trust me, it does not. The only thing you got to do is think a little bit about your foot placement. Once your foot's there, you never have to think about it. It doesn't move and it doesn't feel weird. You know, it's just, if you're used to putting the ball of your foot over the axle, you're going to have to be a little conscious of putting your foot in a different spot when you put your foot on your pedal. But, you know, after a couple of rides, it took me about halfway through my second ride. And when I stopped having to think so much, my foot just kind of started automatically going to the new position. Yeah, once it's there, you don't really have to think about it. But yeah, if you're willing to try something a little different, like I said, it's actually based on some science, then the pedals will work out great. But yeah, if you're just stuck with pushing through the ball of the foot and you're not willing to try a different foot position, then I still think the pedal would, give you a little bit of an advantage over a normal flat, but you're not going to get the intended kind of game-changing differences that that the Catalyst pedal can give you. But so yeah, that's kind of the only caveat. Got to be open-minded and willing to get your foot in the right position.
Yeah, I'm definitely willing to that. So this has been great. Thank you very much, James. I'm really grateful for your time. And so pedalinginnovations.com is where you can find the pedal. And I will, of course, link to that in the show notes. And James's website is James Wilson. Oh, no, it's bikejames.com, isn't it? I almost get that confused. Bikejames.com. So I will, of course, link that as well. And you've got training programs and you've got all kinds of fantastic articles. So
Yeah, I got a ton of free stuff. I mean, I've got several free 30-day programs that people can check out if they're just kind of wanting to get get an idea of what it looks like. And yeah, just a ton of free stuff there. But yeah, I do have full programs, everything from a full, what I call the ultimate MTB workout program down to I call it the No Gym, No Problem bodyweight program. So it's wherever you're at, whatever equipment you've got access to, however much time and energy you have to put into your program, I've got some sort of answer for you to help you get the most out of that time. So, but yeah, man, it really just kind of comes down to helping people have more fun on the trail. I know what strength training's done for me and how much it helped my riding, and I just love hearing from people like you, that helped them as well. And that's what keeps me motivated to keep getting the word out and help save some people from some mindless mundane hours on the trainer and actually get them some result producing swings going or something like that.
Yeah, no, very much. Thank you very much. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, no problem, Christopher. It was fun, buddy. We should yeah, do it again sometime.